Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 21st of June, these are our main stories. Iran warns that it will defend its territory against any aggression after it emerged that President Trump approved, then called off, airstrikes. The Speaker of the Georgian Parliament has resigned after violent protests about a visit by Russian MPs. The poachers in Botswana that are poisoning endangered vultures. Also in this podcast... sounds from a galaxy far, far away made by seals. We begin this podcast with the ongoing tension between Washington and Tehran. Iran is warning that it will defend its territory against any aggression after it emerged that President Trump approved airstrikes on Thursday and then called them off. Media reports in the US say Donald Trump had approved the action in retaliation for the downing of a US surveillance drone. There has been no official comment from the White House, but an unnamed official said an operation was called off abruptly with just hours to go. This report is how the American network CBS carried the story.
Well, there's no question they came very close. In fact, they were already in the process of conducting the operation when President Trump and his administration had that change of heart and pulled back. CBS News was actually able to confirm that. It's possible there were already strikes. There were already planes in the air. We just don't know how far along they were.
Well, our defense and diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, has been speaking to my colleague, Claire McDonnell.
Well, it certainly looks as though these are reliable reports. They seem to come from multiple officials, all essentially suggesting that an attack was ordered, that preparations for that attack were underway, and that kind of at the last minute, the president seems to have had second thoughts and decided to abort the operation. The operation itself would have been something in the order of a punitive strike against the Iranians for having shot down that U.S. unmanned drone, a very expensive, very large reconnaissance gathering aircraft the other day. It would have probably targeted Iranian missile batteries and radars, maybe some naval installations or Air Force installations, we don't know. But as I say, it would have been intended simply as a warning riposte to the shooting down of that aircraft, rather than necessarily the start of some long-running campaign against Iran.
And lots of facts are yet to be confirmed. But if it was the case that it was called off, why? Why the change of heart?
Well, I think it reflects very much the two minds that the Trump administration and indeed the president himself are in. On the one hand, we know Mr. Trump is a man of bellicose rhetoric and emotional outbursts and so on. On the other hand, he seems in his heart of hearts to be very unwilling to draw the Americans into another protracted military struggle in the Middle East. His essential position is to try and get America out of long-standing struggles like Afghanistan and Iraq and so on. So it looks as though these two voices were in play. There are clearly those in the administration who are very hawkish, more generally actually on the civilian side, who want to see some punitive action against Iran. Some of them indeed want to see regime change in Iran. But then I think the military voices in the United States, by and large, are much more cautious. They see any strikes as possibly leading into an open-ended conflict. And so amidst this conflicting advice on the one hand and conflicting emotions in his own mind on the other, the president decided to draw back.
That was Jonathan Marcus. Well, Karin von Hippel was chief of staff to the former US commander of coalition forces in Afghanistan, General John Allen. We spoke to her about the possible strategy being used by Washington.
I think he's trying to show that he's tough, but he's very nervous about war, and that's actually reassuring. You know, he has Bolton and Pompeo on the one side pushing him very hard, super hawkish on Iran, and he himself has promised not to go to war in the Middle East, and he's just in an uncomfortable position. So he wants to appear tough without actually doing anything significant.
That was Karin von Hippel. And literally, as we were hearing those last two interviews, there has been a response from President Trump. He says he called off an overnight attack on Iran with just minutes to spare because too many people would have been killed. He said the Americans were, in his words, cocked and loaded and had three targets in their sights. Well, here in the UK, the race to be the next Prime Minister is down to the final two, the current Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, and his predecessor, Boris Johnson. Mr. Johnson got the most votes from his parliamentary colleagues, and he's better known around the country. He was a flamboyant mayor of London, and he recently got the backing of Donald Trump. But is he trusted by the public? Our reporter Paul Moss went to a Conservative Party club in Blackpool on the northwest coast of England to hear what people there were thinking. First, those who did not want Boris Johnson.
Just can't abide Boris Johnson and his attitude. He's arrogant. He couldn't be bothered to turn up for the first debate. I think he was shamed into turning up to the last one.
Why do you think Boris seems to be so popular? Because he's certainly the bookie's favourite for the leadership.
I don't know why he's so popular. He's not popular with me.
Boris is outside what you would imagine being as a Prime Minister, I think. Arrogant, unpredictable.
A lot of people think the reason Boris Johnson's popular is precisely because he's not like other politicians.
Well, yeah, it's controversial, isn't it? And maybe they do want somebody that will stretch things a little bit. I just don't know if I trust him. I don't know.
Well, then Paul went on to find some other voices in the same club who had the opposite view.
I think that Boris would have more bottle than Jeremy Hunt. We voted to come out of the European Union. I think Boris is the person to do it. He says what he thinks. I just think that Jeremy Hunt is a person very much like Theresa May. He'll do what he feels he should do, but he's not getting us anywhere.
Do you feel you understand what Boris Johnson's plan is for getting Britain out of the EU?
Probably not, but he's saying he's going to do it, and I think if he says he's going to do it, he will do it.
The leadership candidates, they're not like they used to be. They were better and they were more thorough in everything that they said.
Well, there were, I think, more than a dozen people competing for the Conservative leadership this time at the beginning. You're saying none of them match up to previous Conservative leaders?
Absolutely not. Nowhere near. Boris is too comical for me.
Well, Jeremy Hunt's not comical. He's a fairly straight-laced guy, isn't he?
Yeah, but there's not enough there for me. I'd be voting for the Brexit Party.
Those are the thoughts of some people here in Britain to the idea of Boris Johnson being Prime Minister. The number of people who are choosing not to vaccinate their children, known as anti-vaxxers, is one of the top 10 global health risks this year. That's according to the World Health Organization. But the debate about vaccinating is riddled with misinformation and fake news. Scientists say repeatedly that vaccines have never been safer. So why did so many people refuse to trust them? The BBC's population correspondent Stephanie Hegarty reports from Italy on how government policy there, intended to increase the number of children being vaccinated, may be emboldening those who disagree with them.
Under the dull orange glow of a hotel conference room in Padua, about 500 people have gathered to hear this disgraced doctor speak.
It is the greatest thing we've ever done. It's a medical miracle.
He was struck off for publishing a fraudulent study linking vaccines to autism more than 20 years ago. But Andrew Wakefield still manages to draw a crowd. Nassim Langroudi and her organisation Corvelva invited Wakefield here. And as we're speaking, she's tapping her foot impatiently.
It's easy to see that the mainstream media is being piloted on this issue. Even though we've had a lot of protests and we are a big movement, we are constantly being diminished.
Conspiracy theories are fuel for this movement. The idea that the media and the government are being manipulated by pharmaceutical companies to sell parents a lie.
I am Beatrice Lorenzin. I am the former health minister in Italy.
In 2017, Italy was in the midst of one of the worst measles outbreaks in Europe. Lorenzin passed a law to increase the number of mandatory childhood vaccines from 4 to 10. Parents who sent unvaccinated children to school would be fined.
Despite our information campaigns, we weren't able to increase the level of vaccination.
This was because of fake news and the alarming campaigns by the anti-vax movement. And they were supported by some political parties.
Questi stanno litigando sui vaccini.
Rispetto all'approccio della vaccinazione.
She's referring to the Northern League and the Five Star Movement, two populist parties currently in power, both of whom campaigned against her law. And it's not just in Italy.
The beautiful child went to have the vaccine.
Donald Trump spoke against vaccines during his campaign.
Now is autistic.
Though he's changed his mind since.
They have to get the shot. The vaccinations are so important.
Il y a une violation.
And Marine Le Pen chimed in too.
Des libertés individuelles.
It's a story that appeals to populist ideology, and it taps into fear.
Come genitori, ovviamente, se nel
the fear of parents like Sylvia, whose six-year-old son isn't vaccinated and hasn't been to school for a month.
Mi sento, da un lato, minacciato.
Sylvia is part of a group of parents who say they aren't against vaccines, but object to children getting many at the same time, despite the science saying it's safe. And this is a pattern that's repeating itself in the vaccine debate all over the world. But it doesn't have to play out that way.
Were you in this group before?
Sì, sì.
Jenny Arduini used to be against vaccines, but then she found a doctor online who painstakingly answered all of her questions and her doubts.
Litigando con tutti, nel senso che quando ho capito.
She tried to bring this new information to the anti-vaccine groups, but they kicked her out.
Se I dottori fossero preparati.
If doctors were properly prepared to explain things to parents, she says, we wouldn't have all of this fake news. But until that happens, it seems like facts can always be challenged by beliefs.
That was Stephanie Hegarty reporting. The Governor of the Bank of England has given a cautious welcome to Facebook's proposed new digital currency, which is due to be rolled out worldwide next year. But Mark Carney says clear rules will be needed to ensure that the currency, called the Libra, is not allowed to become a network for criminals. Our technology correspondent, Rolly Kecklin-Jones, reports.
Facebook's ambitious plan for a cryptocurrency which would allow people to move money cheaply across borders or make simple online payments has the support of a coalition of companies, including MasterCard and Visa. But politicians have already expressed concern that a social media giant with a poor record on data privacy is moving into finance. The Bank of England governor said Libra had potential, but consumers needed protection.
Anything that works in this world will become instantly systemic and will have to be subject to the highest standards of regulation. So that's of operational resilience, including cyber. It's of anti-money laundering, counter-terrorist financing protections. Data privacy would be required. And then as central banks, we have to look at how the system's evolving and in a coordinated fashion at the level of the G7, the BIS, the FSB, and the IMF. So open mind, but not open door, highest standards.
And it would not be allowed to become a network for criminals and terrorists. That, he suggested, was what had happened with the best-known cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, whose key feature is that it isn't regulated by a central bank.
That was Rory Kecklin-Jones. Still to come in this podcast.
Vultures circling over a carcass can be seen from many, many kilometres away.
Why elephant poachers in Botswana are taking extreme measures to cover their tracks. Now to Georgia, where the Speaker in Parliament has resigned in response to mass protests at his decision to let a Russian lawmaker make a speech in Russian. Hundreds of people, both protesters and police officers, were injured in the clashes, some of them seriously, as the demonstrators pushed against lines of riot police, threw bottles and stones and grabbed riot shields, drawing a tough response. The protesters attempted to storm the parliament after that Russian MP took the speaker's seat in parliament. The Russian politicians had come to Georgia as part of a delegation of Orthodox MPs. The Kremlin spokesperson, Dmitry Peskov, told reporters that the incident was a matter of serious concern.
Everything that happened yesterday in Georgia was nothing but an anti-Russian provocation. And the fact that there were aggressive demonstrations against Russian citizens causes us serious concern.
Tensions, of course, between Russia and Georgia are high. 11 years after the two countries fought a war over the breakaway region of South Ossetia. Our correspondent in Tbilisi, Rehan Dimitri, told Claire McDonnell more about these latest developments.
Irakli Kobakhidze is the parliament speaker and he's not a very popular politician in the country, and his resignation was one of the demands last night by the protesters and the opposition. They're also demanding the resignation of the interior minister. I'm just coming from a protest that was organized outside the interior ministry by a group of journalists. They held photographs of their colleagues that got injured yesterday, and they're saying that at least 34 journalists and people who work for media organizations were hurt in the clashes yesterday because the authorities, they didn't give any warning before they started firing tear gas to disperse the crowd. So that's one thing, and the figure is really high, the number of journalists who were injured. Also earlier today, the health ministry, they said that overall 240 people were injured in those clashes, including at least 80 policemen. So this is a really fast-moving story, and now we're seeing the resignation of the parliament speaker.
And on a broader view of this story, how dangerous are these escalating tensions between the two countries then?
It was the presence of Russian MPs and the fact that they entered parliament building. It was, we've heard from the Russian MP who is in the middle of this storm. He spoke to Russian newspaper Kommersant, and he said that negotiations with the Georgian authorities were underway for 2 years before this meeting of Orthodox MPs from 26 countries finally took place in Tbilisi. So questions are now probably from the protesters, and more protests are planned for later tonight. The questions will be from protesters towards their government. How did they allow this Russian MP to address the Georgian parliament in Russian language?
Rehan Dimitri. More than 500 critically endangered vultures have been killed by poison in Botswana in what conservationists have described as one of the largest recorded killings of the threatened species. Our Africa correspondent Alistair Leithhead in Nairobi told Andrew Peachmore.
The government of Botswana said that they had discovered or they had visited this site of a total of 537 vultures and two tawny eagles which had been found dead at this site in a wildlife management area in the central district of Botswana, and that they'd been poisoned, and they believed that the poisoning was caused by the lacing of three poached elephant carcasses with a chemical in order to kill these birds. Now, the reason that poachers who would kill elephants for ivory would then poison the carcass is that vultures circling over a carcass, whether it's killed by humans or by predators, can be seen from many, many kilometres away. And so it's a warning sign, if you like, to those trying to stop poachers. And so they would have poisoned the animals, the government believes, in order to prevent them being caught.
And is that a common thing, the poisoning of the elephant carcasses so that the vultures aren't a giveaway? Does that happen all the time?
There is poison is used in some instances in various parts of Africa to try and do this. But I think the extent of the deaths in this case is quite extraordinary. It's one of the most serious incidents of its kind there's been in southern Africa. Of these more than 500 vultures, 468 of them were white-backed vultures, 14 were leopard-faced, 10 were caped, 17 white-headed, 28 hooded. About 500 of them are critically endangered under the CITES, the IUCN, declaration. This is the International Union for Conservation of Nature. They have this red list of endangered species, and these vultures are on that list. So a very serious crisis for these vultures.
That was Alistair Leithhead. Many types of birds are known for their ability to mimic human voices and sounds, from parrots saying phrases to the Indian minor bird copying camera shutter sounds and chainsaws. Impressive stuff. But when we travel from the skies to the seas, those skills seem to have been lost until now, as scientists have taught seals to sing. Our reporter Jonathan Savage has been listening in.
The team at St Andrews University in Scotland say they were amazed. And why wouldn't they be? They managed to teach a seal to sing. Three, in fact. OK, let's see if you're equally impressed. Which legendary movie theme is this seal singing? If you guess Star Wars, you're very good. I mean, it's not exactly Frank Sinatra, sorry, Sinatra you're listening to, but given the example the seal was played, it's not a bad impression for a semi-aquatic marine mammal. And here's the seal's version one more time. So what exactly is going on here? Professor Vincent Yannick is the man whose team trained three seals to sing up to 10 notes of their chosen pieces of music.
Other animals that can copy sounds, like whales and dolphins, produce sounds very differently from us. But with seals it's different. They really actually use the larynx and their vocal cords and their mouth in the same way as we do when we speak. We're constantly moving our jaws, and the animals do that as well when they're modifying their sounds.
So that's how, but why? It's because these singing seals are actually guinea pigs. Stay with me. Professor Yannick says they can test different methods of human speech therapy on these fast-learning fish lovers.
What works better? What helps the slow learners to be quicker? And all those kinds of things can be answered with these animals in a way that you couldn't do with a human, simply because we, of course, grow up with our parents. We constantly exchange sounds with our parents. And that makes it very difficult to have a controlled studies on what kind of inputs actually lead to ultimately to learning and to proper vocal development.
So their singing isn't perfect, but neither is Bob Dylan's, and it never held him back. Science says these seals are stars. So twinkle, twinkle.
Jonathan Savage reporting with some help from some very vocal seals. And that's it, almost, for this edition of the Global News Podcast. But if you've got a few more minutes to spare and you're interested in some of the less reported stories from around the world, then stay with us for News from Elsewhere with Martin Morgan from BBC Monitoring. So, Martin, I gather there's been a bit of a mystery over a road sign in a Russian city. What's going on?
Well, in Yekaterinburg in Russia, there's a series of road signs have appeared one after the other. One day it said, "Welcome to Yekaterinburg, city of demons." The next day, "Welcome to Yekaterinburg, city of heroes." The demon reference is to the way the Kremlin propagandists were bad-mouthing protesters. There were protests held last month in the city. The new sign about them being city of heroes seemed to be a reference to the local governor saying, "We're heroes, we're brave, we're not demons." So there's a lot of talk about whether this is some sort of publicity stunt. It's still a mystery, because in Russia you can see what's going on, but you can't always find out why.
And Martin, meanwhile in Finland, there's a bit of a mystery over what's coming out of the radio.
Yes, you'd normally expect to hear Finnish, maybe a bit of Swedish, but what's been coming out recently is Latin.
So, Martin, why the Latin?
Why the Latin? Well, a couple of university professors about 30 years ago thought it would be interesting in Finland to broadcast the news once a week in Latin, and they've been doing that, and it's picked up a huge international following amongst people who think it's, you know, a good way of trying to revive Latin as a spoken language, not to take over the world, but, you know, just to keep people interested in it. Finnish radio's decided that although this is a great thing, there's enough Latin on the internet now that they don't really need to keep the broadcast up, which some people think is a bit of a shame. But Vatican Radio, maybe appropriately, is now going to be running its own news in Latin, but it's obviously going to be more Catholic Church focused. But Finnish radio is keeping an archive of this stuff, so anybody who wants to hear it, you can go in there and hear the news in Latin anytime you like.
From Latin, let's move on to Estonia and their sauna festival.
That's right, in Rakvere, they have a regular sauna festival, but this year there's something very unusual. You'd see an old yellow Audi estate. The only odd thing about it is it's got a big black chimney sticking out of the bonnet, and the windows are steamed up. It's like a drive-by sauna, basically. It's been built by some local enthusiasts. They can literally take it on the road from one town to another, and you can sit in there, fits five people in. €200 it cost them, better than building it from scratch.
What a bargain. Martin Morgan from BBC Monitoring, thanks very much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World This Week. And Sean Lay joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
Well, you could say it's a case of whodunit this week. Jacques Hughes, Russians face charges 5 years after the shooting down of a passenger plane over Ukraine. Mea culpa, why some Japanese medical schools admit having fiddled the figures, discriminating against women becoming doctors. A case of fratricide in Britain's ruling Conservative Party as it chooses a new Prime Minister in time for Brexit. And as Egypt's ex-president collapses in court and dies, why he's been treated like an unidentified body. Join us as we unravel the clues.
Thanks, Sean. And that's all in The World This Week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website, www.bbc.co.uk/programmes. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.